Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Afternoon Tune. I am host Josh, and I got a special interview today. Going to be interviewing Professor John Jennings. John Jennings, Hugo Award-winning, Eisner-winning professor, scholar, best-selling author, curator, graphic novelist, editor, design theorist, all-around expert on everything comics. How's it going there, Mr. Jennings?
How you doing, Josh? Thank you for having me. I'm doing pretty good. It's a little rainy out here in, you know, sunny California, but, you know, we're making it.
So. Oh, very good. I know I gave you that intro, but you want to tell people about yourself, who you are, where you're from, things like that?
Yeah, sure. My name is John Jennings. As Josh said, I'm a professor of media and cultural studies at the University of California at Riverside. As far as like my work, I do a lot of work around representations of Blackness in comics and science fiction and horror, right? So here I teach courses on Afrofuturism and comics. I teach a course on Black horror and just a general course just about like comics and contemporary culture. And originally I'm from Mississippi, born and raised, and went to school at Jackson State University, finished up at University of Illinois, and have been teaching for about 20 years or so. And most of my my work was as an artist. I was trained as an artist. So I was teaching the graphic design programs for about 16 years. And then I switched over to teaching media studies. But I'm also a editor and curator at Abrams Megascope, which is a imprint that I founded that deals with people of color and speculative fiction. And so we've been doing that for almost 5 years now. And I'm also a graphic novelist working with my friend Damian Duffy. We've adapted two of Octavia Butler, soon to be three of Octavia Butler's science fiction stories. That's Kindred and Parable of the Sower, and we're working on Parable of Talents now. So,
very good. And this is the Megascope site right here, abramsbooks.com, that people can check it out and everything like that. And this is also your own personal site right here. Yes. Where that people can check out, learn more about you. And how I found you was from this right here, which was My Superhero is Black, which is talking about all the various kind of different Black superheroes there within comic books.
Within DC, Marvel Comics in particular.
Yes, Marvel Comics in particular there. And you see various ones, Nick Fury, Black Panther. You see Moon Girl there, which I actually just saw her show right there. Very good show, by the way.
It's actually well done. Yeah.
That's on Disney Plus right now. Yes. Is that that's Isaiah Bradley, correct?
Yes, that's Isaiah Bradley. Yep. And yeah. Blue Marvel. You know, and some of your leading characters, that is co-written with my good friend Angelique Roche. And we are currently finishing up edits and stuff on that. So, you know, thank you for your patience because it's not out yet. It'll be out, hopefully soon.
So. Yeah. And I make sure to be picking up a copy of that. Have you done much of convention work going out to things like that?
I've actually, I generally am at San Diego Comic-Con pretty much every year in a capacity or in some capacity. A lot of people don't realize this, but there's also like a scholarly aspect to San Diego Comic-Con. They actually have this thing called the Comics Art Conference, and that's how I started going to it. It's actually a separate event that actually is also owned by Comic-Con International, where professors can go and talk about their work. So that's actually how I started going to Comic-Cons. And because I do both, I'm an artist and a scholar, I was able to kind of segue into doing comics that way. But yeah, I mean, I go to San Diego, New York Comic Con. I've been to quite a bit. I actually helped co-organize and create Black comic book conventions too, like the one in Harlem at the Schomburg Center for research in Black culture. I'm one of the co-founders of that, which is like probably the largest Black convention in the country. And then CamCon, which is at the California African-American Museum. I have co-found that. And also, you know, the Black comic book, the Black and Brown Comic Arts Festival in San Francisco, to name a few. So I've been, not only do I go to the conferences, but also like I, you know, help create them for us, essentially. So,
and you've been doing this for multiple decades now, right? Working in comics.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, a couple of decades now. I mean, I think I just made a couple, like 20 some odd years. You know, I started doing independent work. Me and my friend Damien started out as comic scholars doing curatorial work, right? So the first big thing that we did was this show called Out of Sequence, Underrepresented Voices in American Comics. And it was a curated exhibition that we did at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign back in the early 2000s, like 2008 or so. And from there, we kind of segued into doing experimental comics. And then before you know it, we ended up getting a chance to adapt Octavia Butler's Kindred into a graphic novel, which was our first like major project. But before then, we were doing independent work. We were doing a lot of experimental stuff. We're doing like interactive comics and comics that are projected on walls, just kind of messing around with the medium, you know? But as I said before, I was, you know, my main gig was like I was teaching. So I was doing like design history and stuff like that too. But I always wanted to do like graphic design. I mean, graphic novels and stuff. So.
This is the Out of Sequence there right here, the painting installation. Very, very nice. Very well done there. Check out. So since you've been in it for a minute now, you notice a lot more Black creatives kind of coming up than you did before when you kind of started out there?
Yes, I have. So one of the things that was interesting is like when we started working on just surveying, like just a representation of people from different backgrounds, not only like race, but also like, you know, sexual preference, gender, class, even, you know, we were looking at like, well, who's making comics and how are they getting the work out, you know? And that's when I discovered Hero Talk, you know, and the Museum of Black Superheroes that Omar Bilal created. It was online back in the day. And Hero Talk was like the message boards. And so a lot of the brothers and sisters that were on there back in the day, you know, became really good friends. And, you know, we would get into discussions about that. And also there was a major conference that still goes on called the East Coast of Black Age of Comics Convention, ECBAC, you know, which is at Temple University. It's the oldest, Black comic convention. It's in Philadelphia. And that's where the Glyph Awards are given out, which is like, almost like it's almost like the Image Awards of comics. It's like the Image Awards and Eisner's put together, you know, for comics. Okay. So yeah, and that's given out at that convention. So that's kind of like where we started, is kind of looking at the lay of the land. And I think because of the fact that the tools to make comics actually became a lot more affordable, you know, as far as like being able to afford like the Adobe Creative Suite and stuff like that. And then, and also too, like major advances in like drawing digitally and things like that. And actually like the growth of the internet, I think was a huge deal too, like as far as like being and so we moved out of the chat rooms and being like the only Black person in the comics to having like a whole community with like social media, right? Mm. And I think the last big thing I think was printing on demand technology, being actually able to take your ideas and put them up and, you know, print them out and actually sell them at conventions and stuff. So that, I think those different things helped like propel us into the space we are now, where you have like, you know, extremely gifted Black creators who are making a living and doing some great work that is on par with, you know, and better actually in some instances than the big two are putting out as far as like story and, you know, things of that nature. So yeah, I think we're in kind of like the golden age of the Black age of comics, you know, so to speak. It's like, there's a lot of really good work out there.
Yeah. And like I say, you know, seeing a lot more people, seeing a lot more Black people in this space now. Any advice you want to kind of say to them at all? Like,
well, I mean, you know, it's funny because looking at the political climate, I'd be like, you know, stay safe and, but speak your truth. But the other thing is, you know, don't quit, because if it's something that you love, then you should not stop doing it. You know, it's one of the things that I kind of lament is like when I came out of the when I came out of school, I was trying to get, you know, I was trying to like draw like someone else. I was trying to be like, you know, Neil Adams clone or like, you know, that kind of thing. I would say like make the work the way that you need to make it, you know what I'm saying? And keep making it because there's an audience out there for you, you know? So yeah, that's what I would say.
Okay. So your work, so you being a professor at UCR, University of California at Riverside there, you work with specifically, you know, examining media from a Black lens, examining a lot of that things. So what do you kind of usually do in your classes? Do you take typically a Black film and then do you kind of have the students break it down in a way?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, so we're in a, so media and cultural studies is a program. It's kind of a young program that kind of like grew out of film studies and like, you know, literary studies, like comparative literature. So you what you have is like a lot of professors who are into different media, you know, who might be English professors or they might be film studies professors who are treating that like a like another type of text, like a traditional text. And so, like you said, they start breaking it down. They start thinking about the symbolism of it. They're thinking about like production side of things. And the other thing, a bunch of us are also makers of media, you know, so we have like people who are musicians in our program. We have people who design games, right, in our program, practicing artists, filmmakers, dancers, you know, who are also scholars who are actually doing critical making and actually studying the medium like that. So we teach the students to not only be makers of things, but be really, really cognizant of the systems that produce, you know, media, that kind of thing. So for instance, right now I'm teaching my a class called Afrofuturism and the Visual Cultures of Horror, right? Mm. The students call it the Get Out class. So we basically will look at like representations of Blackness in horror films. And then we have like a bevy of like readings and films that we engage with, but also comics too, because we're talking about images, right? You know, so we like, for instance, this last week we talked about the idea of being able to slip in and out of people's bodies, right? What does that mean on a psychological level, and when you consume someone's body by actually literally being in their flesh, you know, that kind of thing, right? So Get Out, we looked at a film like Jezebel. We looked at the film Spell, you know. We also looked at Talk to Me, things like that, where there's some type of power that allows you to kind of slip in and out of the body. So what happens is like, you can actually wear someone else's skin without having the repercussions of actually being that person, you know? So it's like this really, really tripped out fantasy. So these are some of the things we talk about in the courses, and then what are the social forces that create these things? So, yeah.
And hello, how's it going there, Mike Edgewood? He's a animator himself. He does a lot of media there, so up and coming animator, great works there. So shout out to him. You're starting to see, like you said, a bloom of, a newer term, I guess, a lot of people are throwing around now, Afrofuturism. A lot of that people threw out with Black Panther, with that film there. And you also see that with a lot of kind of horror kind of going in that. Jordan Peele obviously is an example of that. Mm-hmm. Did you see the movie? You probably already have, Candyman, at all?
Yeah, yeah. We actually I taught both of them, you know, in my class, actually. The original and the spiritual sequel, you know, yeah.
And this one, so there was two versions. There was the original one. The original one was directed by a white director, and then this one was directed by a Black female director, Nia DaCosta, who went on to do the Marvels there. Mm-hmm. And one of the criticisms with this movie was that it focused, and this was also coming from Black people, but it focused maybe too much on a racial aspect there, as far as maybe it was too heavy-handed. You know, if Black people are in something that is horror or sci-fi, it has to relate back to their Blackness. Do you ever feel like that is an issue at all? Of like, why, you know, if it's a slasher movie, why can't just be, okay, Black people are just in the woods and then it's a slasher? Instead, the slasher has to be a metaphor for racism. Do you ever encounter any issue like that?
You know, I go back and forth about it. Yeah, because we are more than the skin we're in. I think that with Candyman, though, because of the fact that it is like derived from a story that was dealing directly with race, that it makes sense to me for the sequel to do so. You know, so many of those particular systems are connected to racism. I mean, I thought it was a far more nuanced film than the first one. Actually, I thought it was a better film in a lot of ways, actually, because I had a lot of issues with the first Candyman. Why was Candyman actually like haunting black people? He should have been actually killing white folk if that was how he was lynched and such stuff like that. I always had issues with that. I feel like Nia DaCosta did a really great like nuanced conversation, and she didn't pardon the pun, but she didn't let anybody off the hook, so to speak, right? Because she was actually talking about like how everyone actually kind of like profits off of black people's trauma. She was actually talking, I think, a lot about gentrification and things of that nature. But what I liked about the film is that she didn't actually really show us the violence. It was always, you know, reflections of the violence and that kind of thing. She would show us shadows, and she would actually kind of, you know, show us askance of the violence. I thought it was a very well-lensed film, personally. But I do see the critique as far as like, why does it always have to be about race? And I think what it is that we're still unpacking what it means to be black and be subject as well. You know, I mean, we're in a renaissance of like us being seen. You know, for a long time we were not in films at all, and then we do get the films, we're killed off or we're treated as side characters. So I think we're in an age now where we're still trying to figure out how to be the center of the conversation. You know. Which I think is really interesting. So we're still like going through those things, but I felt like, I don't think it was heavy handed at all. I thought it was really beautifully executed and very subtle. In fact, I feel like the shadow puppet show at the end of it was one of the most heart wrenching things I've ever seen, because it was showing us racialized violence without actually showing us gore, you know? And because it was showing like these actual violences against black men. Yes, exactly. Without actually showing, you know, blood or like gore, you know, and she's the makings of a really brilliant filmmaker. Actually, I think that, yeah, she's a very, very smart woman. So, and you can see like the homage to the first one, you know, but also. Just picking up on the things, I just felt like it was a really strong film. But anyway, let me stop.
Yeah, I love the sequence too. I love the what they do there with the kind of the art there with it.
It's beautiful. Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of care. I feel like, you know, Peele, Monkey Paw, this whole like over that he's created is a lot more subtlety. Because we are black people living in this space, and we are still trying to deal with like the trappings of race and things of that nature. That's still a problem. And honestly, I really don't have an issue with propaganda about what happens to black people in the country. I feel like sometimes we need to be a little bit louder, you know, in fact, because if you look around us right now, we're in a political climate that is extremely volatile, you know? So I'm like, well, I don't have time to actually make art. I need to make some statements. So my art always has statements in it. You know, I make work about the social issues that deal with my people, but also like just in general. But I do see what you're saying. Like, we should just be able to make a film that's like, you know, it's a monster movie. The black, because your blackness is apparent just because of being who you are, right?
So I do understand the escapism nature of it. If somebody want to go to a theater and then be like, okay, I just want to relax, I want to chill out, and, you know, I mean, just see, like you said, just a monster movie, you know, the monster attacks, you know, and then, you know, it's like it's Scooby-Doo, the monster takes off the hood and then boom, it's white supremacy, you know what I mean? It's like, okay,
right.
You know. So I kind of get that in a sense there with some people in the complaint. And with, you said, you speak about this politically charged climate that we're in right now. And a word that kind of gets thrown around in that politically charged climate, you know, is something like wokeness, is something like that kind of there. Yeah. What's kind of your opinion on that? And do you think that media literacy is an issue with that as far as people interpreting things of what is and what isn't woke?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, actually, Josh. So first of all, I think media literacy is extremely valuable. It's extremely important. And I think that it should be taught super early, because kids are inundated with so many images, you know, before they're like able to actually process them. You know, I remember reading something about like, we see more images in a day than someone from the 17th century would see in their entire lifetime. right? Something like that. Yeah, which totally makes sense. I was like, wow, that's crazy. Just when you think about it, you know, so we don't have time to rest and actually like think about what we're actually processing. So I think that media literacy should be taught like super early, like as soon as we could, because the formations of who we are start so early on. As far as like the term woke, I mean, it's funny because, you know, that is a term that comes out of the Black community that has been reappropriated by, you know, right wing anti-progressives, you know what I'm saying? And actually, I have to commend them for it. I mean, it was done brilliantly, you know, because now it's been turned into this bad thing, right? But I'm like, well, okay, well, I would rather the opposite of being woke is being asleep, you know? Right. So you're saying you want people to be ignorant or unconscious then, you know? So I'm like, okay, fine. Stay unconscious, and I'll just continue making the work that I do that I feel will hopefully change things in this society. I think it was a really brilliant turn of phrase. I mean, I hate that it happened that way, but, you know, a lot of times folk in those spaces are really good wordsmiths and actually able to like spin, are really good at like being spin doctors, you know? Because even the term social justice warrior has been turned into like a bad thing. I was like, so let me get this straight. So Rosa Parks and Dr. King, that's bad now. So I'm like, okay. Yeah, so it's this really strange wordplay, you know? I feel that we're in a space now where we have to be really, you know, careful about the stuff that we say because we're on social media, what have you. But also, I really feel like we should always try to speak truth to power and make the work that we feel we should be making in the world, regardless of who's saying what about it. You know, it's also kind of heartbreaking because we're like the most connected that we've ever been as a people, like as a society. Mm. But because of the fact that certain folk make particular money from us being separated, that we actually don't get a chance to see what we have in common with everybody else, you know? And I think that is, you know, that's something that has been really, really used very well to kind of separate. This is one of the most segregated, like, political climates I've ever seen in my life, you know, at this particular point in history, you know? And I think it's a shame because our democracy is in danger and the world is watching. Because we're still an experiment, you know, so yeah. It's like still a democratic experiment. So, yeah, we'll see how it shakes out.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, Afrofuturism isn't a new term. It was coined in the 1990s, like 1993.
Ah, uh-huh. Okay.
So there's been a resurgence of it, I think, because of different things. I think this new interest in Afrofuturism probably started with the election of Barack Obama. That's my theory because. Before his election, you would only see a Black president in a science fiction movie, if you think about it. And so I feel like when people saw Obama as like a president in the present, they were like, wow, we're in the future now. Racism is over. It's like, not at all, actually. And so now we've seen like this gradual swing back to the right, like the extreme right in some spaces, because there's a fear of loss of identity as far as like what America is and what America means, you know? To certain people, right? So
you speak about the loss of identity, how some people fear that, and you see that kind of reaction online when you do have characters, you know, knowing your cover here, My Superhero is Black, mm-hmm. You do have the character of Miles Morales here, Spider-Man, mm-hmm. which, you know, people fear that, you know what I mean? People say, no, Peter Parker is Spider-Man, Miles Morales is Miles Morales, and you know what I mean? He will always be that. And it seems like a kind of fear that you know, or anger that people, you know, he's coming up, he's popular right now, you know, probably one of the most popular variants of a character that we've seen, especially like we've seen, you know, it's been done before, you know, yeah. I mean, Sam Wilson, you know, mm-hmm. Captain America, you know, various kind of there, Isaiah Bradley, but, you know, never before have we, you know, this character has his own video game series, movie series, and he hasn't even been introduced into live action yet. And this character really isn't relatively even that old. He's only about a little over a decade old.
I want to say what, 2011 is when he was created, I think.
Yeah.
Something like that.
So, you know, what's kind of your opinion on, you know, because usually what these people say is, you know, if you want Black characters, create original Black characters, but when you try to make more of a push and effort to create original more Black characters, it's like, okay, that's forced, and it's, you know, diversity, and it's forced diversity. What's kind of your opinion there on that?
First of all, no one talks about the forced homogeneity, right?
Right.
Because yeah, as far as like, it's like the forced homogenous nature of characters, right? I mean, if anybody is over, is like extremely overrepresented, is like, you know, straight white men are like really over, you know, represented, right? But that's become normalized because of the amount of media around them, right? And don't get me wrong. I mean, I love, like, Spider-Man is one of my favorite, like Peter Parker is one of my absolute favorite characters. In fact, my favorite character, like superhero, is Daredevil. I love that character since I was 12, right? So I just want to get that straight. So this is complex because, you know, in comics, you have this idea called a legacy character, right?
Right.
And so that could be a character that either is directly connected to a superhero character, like the Phantom, for instance, is probably one of the first, maybe the first, like legacy character, you know, from the 1930s,
yeah,
where his son would actually take the mantle of the Phantom, right? And then, of course, you have like a character that's inspired by the character, or like a revamping of the character, like Barry Allen takes up the mantle from Jay Garrick, right? Which is the, yeah, beginning of the Silver Age, right? So these are some of these are different versions of the legacy character. And so I've been talking to my friend Michael Norton Dando about this because he's working on a book about the Blue Beetle, which is, you know, the current iteration is a legacy character called, was it Jaime Reyes, right?
Just had a movie come out last year.
Just had a movie come out, exactly. So what we've been talking about, this is something that he's thinking, this is directly connected to how Dando is thinking about it, is that these characters are like heirlooms. They're like indexes of nostalgia, the indexes of identity, right? Because you think about it, the superhero is an American construct. And ever since the 1950s, when Superman said he stands for truth, justice, and the American way, right? The superhero is an American construct. So that means that, you know, everybody who's in America actually should probably have a superhero that represents them, for good or ill, whatever that means, right? So that's one thing, I think, because that, and that comes from like the 1950s. So what's interesting about like what's jumping off with mainstream comics now is because of the fact that the big two are not comic book companies anymore, you know, that they're intellectual property management, you know, kind of businesses to a certain degree, where, you know, Spider-Man is an IP, he's an intellectual property. It's a wonderful character, but, you know, licensing is where Marvel and DC gets most of their money from, you know. That's where most of their funds come from. So you're in a particular space where like superheroes, they traffic in a particular type of commodified nostalgia, mm-hmm, right? Where like, ooh, I want to, this reminds me of my childhood. And so what happens is like you project part of yourself onto this thing, like your commodity self is like, oh, you know, like I'm a Doctor Who fan, right? So I'm thinking, oh, Doctor Who, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's a part of you, you know? And so when people start changing things, you're like, oh, that makes me feel bad. It makes me feel like you're taking something from me, right?
Yeah.
Never think of like gaining something, right? So yeah, so it's hard to actually like update those characters too, because guess what? The readership for comics has dwindled. Like this is not the golden age of comics, right? There's no such thing as mainstream comics from that particular standpoint, the way I look at it. Mm. Case in point, when the Green Lantern movie came out, the one with Ryan Reynolds, right? Yeah. My mother called me and she was like, you ever heard of Green Lantern? And I was like, yes, he's actually one of the most popular superheroes ever created. She's like, oh yeah, I think I might check it. I like Ryan Reynolds, right? Mm. My wife is an X-Men fan of the movies because she thought that they were based on the cartoons. She didn't even know that they were comic books, right? Mm. So we're talking about something that's really actually really niche. You know, everybody ain't rushing to the school. Everybody don't have a Wednesday pull or a Tuesday pull like we have, right? They're not mainstream characters. They have their mainstream intellectual properties, and people have so much investment in them. It's mind blowing to me. So it's very difficult to actually get somebody to get behind a new character. I just created a new character called Ghostlight, right, for Marvel. Brand new black character that came out of the Silver Surfer universe. So a character like Miles Morales, there's a lot of folk who that is their Spider-Man, right? Because of the fact that he's extremely popular in video games and things of that nature. Think of the superhero now as a franchise, okay? So like that symbol on their chest isn't just an emblem anymore, it's a logo, right? So what's happening is the same thing that's always happened in American capitalism, is that if something is successful, they're gonna change it a little bit and make different versions of it, right? So think of like Peter Parker as like Coca-Cola. So now you got Cherry Coke, Diet Coke. You know what I'm right. saying? It's the same kind of idea, because that is where their money is coming from. It's not from selling comic books. It's from the licensing of those characters. So you can't change them a lot. So even when, for instance, when Peter Parker got his black and white costume that later became the, you know, the symbiote costume, right? That costume, no matter how dope it is, because we know it's beautiful,
right?
They couldn't keep him in that costume because guess what? How many people have actually paid for the license of the version of the red and blue costume? Like how many people, other businesses that Marvel has partnerships with, right? So these are the conversations when I see this, I'm like, you know, no, people are not going to get that. What was the last successful like superhero, like that is a big superhero that isn't a legacy character from either one of the big two, like a brand new superhero that everybody knows about? Like, what is that character?
Yeah.
Was it Deadpool?
Like
what's the last dope character that's hot that's not a legacy character?
The Guardians? Guardians of the Galaxy?
The Guardians of the Galaxy? Guardians of the Galaxy were created in the 1970s.
Okay. Yeah.
So they're like Space Avengers. I used to collect it when I was young. I was young once.
Yeah.
Like, so Martin X, you know, Starhawk, Yondu. Those are my Guardians, right? So this new Guardians, those are old characters. All right, so let's do it again. Like, what's a new character? Mm. It's probably Deadpool, right?
Probably, yeah, I guess that.
But because of the movies, right? Yeah. I mean, because I didn't like Deadpool in the comic books. He's hilarious. I love Ryan Reynolds as Deadpool because he's so derivative. He's like Spider-Man and like the Deathstroke Terminator mixed with like Wolverine.
Right.
It's super derivative, right? So what I'm saying is that even that is like, even Deadpool's like, that's a long time ago. If he was created in the early 90s, right, that's still like what, over 20 some years, 30 years, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's true. So we're watching stories that have been created in the 1960s, you know, or earlier, right? Yeah. Spider-Man was created in 1963.
Yeah.
Batman was created in 1939, for God's sake, right? So these are old ideas that people are just not catching up to. So, you know, there's a ton of them and people have this love for them and stuff like that. But honestly, I like the idea that they have like these different versions of characters because that's what we do. They're just different aspects of the same character. You know, because guess what? I think that Marvel would love to make, or DC would love to make, like brand new characters. But guess what? People don't really like new stuff. They say they do, but you know, 9 times out of 10, they're gonna be like, well, I wanna go see the new Star Wars movie. Because they're trying to actually reignite that lightning in the bottle, but at the same time, you wanna change it a little bit, but still keep it the same. Because that's what people want. They don't necessarily want anything that's really brand new, you know, as far as I could tell, you know. So, yeah, miss me with that nonsense. I'm like, no, no, you don't want new characters. You want the same character. Or maybe you even want a character that's, you know, so some people want, like, you know, a black version of Superman. But we have Icon, for God's sake. You know, we have that. We have so many black superheroes, like, that are, like, we have, like, Blue Marvel is a Superman analog, for God's sake. So Blue Marvel was created when was Blue Marvel created? I mean, he's not super popular. Like, people don't know the character as well.
You really got to know comics to know.
That's what I'm saying. So, like, and people don't know comics like that.
His first appearance was in 2008.
So, check this out. Do you know who Raina Telgemeier is?
No, I wouldn't say I do.
Raina Telgemeier is one of the biggest selling graphic novelists in the world. She writes for kids. She outsells Dark Knight. She outsells Watchmen, right? Raina Telgemeier. Mm-hmm. She has stories called like Ghost Smile. People's kids are reading them left and right. Right. Diary of a Wimpy Kid has sold 250 million copies worldwide. That's what's running comics. The other thing that's dominating comics right now is, of course, what do you call it? Webtoons. Right. So people are not stopping reading comics. It's just that we hold on. There you go. That's Raina. True story. She actually sprained her wrist in Texas signing books. She has to wear a brace on her arm now because she hurt herself signing books. Right. She's one of the top selling graphic novels in the country.
Wow.
Right. So anyway, I'm done. Yeah, so I think people get in their feelings about it, but it's because they have this really strong connection to this fictional character, you know. Personally, I'm really into creating my own intellectual property. It's like, I'm like, you know, that Blade movie is going to happen. Fine. They own that character. If they make some out of Ghost Light, guess what? You know, I was work for hire. They own Ghost Light. If they want to do something with them, fine. That's cool too. You know, I'm going to watch Peter Parker and Miles Morales. I'm going to watch like a Marvel movie and Ms. Marvel. I like both the characters. I'm like, there's room for all of it. You know, I think it's just, it's funny to me that people still have these conversations online that I used to have when I was like 10. So,
yeah. And you speak about that, like the symbol being, you know, it's all about the intellectual property.
Yeah.
And you see that with something like Madam Web here, of with Sony, they have partial control, majority control over Spider-Man, Spider-Man IP. And you, right. they just seems like, you know, they want to make just more Spider-Man stuff. They want to do a Kraven the Hunter movie. They want to do Venom movies. They want to do.
They have to, though.
They have to.
They have to actually keep control of the character. Yeah. So I think, what is it, every 5 years they have to make a movie or something like that?
I believe so.
Yeah. Yeah. So they have to. So it's, even if it's a bad movie, they got to make a movie. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because they want to keep Spider-Man, because that's the deal. You know, yeah. People can realize that these things are being made not because of the fact that people want them, because people be like, who wanted the Echo TV show? You know, they probably have a contract that actually demands that they make a certain amount of intellectual property or else, right?
Right.
Regardless of what you want it or not, right? So that's the thing. It's like the market is all these different things already set, you know? So yeah, I didn't want to, I'm like, Madam Webb, the old lady in the chair? I'm like, really? We gonna make that movie? Okay. You know? Venom, I have not seen the Venom movies. I don't like Venom as a character. I always thought it was a plot point that became a character. A lot of stuff that happened in the 90s, I was not a big fan of. And so I'm older than, you know, I'm like Generation X. So, you know, so I started reading comics like in the 80s, like late 70s, early 80s. So I seen like a sea change of things happen. The 90s was a bad decade for comics in the mainstream, I feel, you know. But we also got stuff like, you know, Vertigo Comics, we got Milestone. We got some really interesting things too, but too many the same thing that's happening with like with Marvel movies right now happened to Marvel with the comics. Too many crossovers, you know, a glut of too much stuff coming out that sometimes was up and down with quality, you know, and it was putting a lot of strain on the creators. And that's why Image was formed, because they were like, you know what? We quit. We're going to start our own company, you know, and now we got The Walking Dead.
And yeah, you kind of see that you mentioned just the companies, the corporations putting this crackdown of just like more, you know, just pumping it out.
Right.
Because it's like, well, this is what people want, you know what I mean? With making all this money. And that's the end, at the bottom line, end of the day, it's about the money. And it's about, you know, creating all these different various video games, shows, movies, you know, everything like that to capitalize off of that. Necessarily always the creator's fault there.
Most time it's not. I mean, a lot of times there's a lot of pressure on people to make these things, you know, and you know, people got to eat. We're in a space where everything is fungible, which means everything is consumable. You know, even our identities, you know, are up for sale. You know, literally, like our very DNA, we have to, like, you know, subscribe to Ancestry DNA so we can learn about ourselves. I mean, it's crazy. We live in this topsy turvy like Blade Runner world. You know, like, it's crazy. So yeah, so yes. When people are saying like they should do this, I saw this one post, I forgot where it was, about like if Marvel like really believed that, you know, Miles Morales was the Spider-Man, that they would just kill Peter Parker. And I was like, not if Sony has anything to do with it. You know what I'm saying? I was like, no, I mean, because Marvel doesn't totally own that character, so they can't do something like that. That is probably against the rules. Also, too, like I said, you know, think about all the stuff that has Spider-Man, Peter Parker licenses and stuff. It's bigger than the comics. You know, the comics are like awesome. I love them. I'm surrounded by them. But, you know, that's not what's making the money.
So. And yeah, you mentioned the power of the studio, because that was a situation I remember, because for a long time, Marvel didn't own Disney didn't own the rights to X-Men. So they canceled a lot of the X-Men comics and tried to push more than humans and tried to push that in the TV shows like Age of the Shield and everything like that. It's like inhumans, because we don't want the X-Men to gain light, because we don't want another company to really make
which is money. Really shady.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah. But they didn't own X-Men again until they bought Fox.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah.
I'm like, can we get a X-Men Aliens crossover? Can we get that? Because I mean, essentially that's what they were trying to do with the Brood anyway, right? That's the Brood is just alien, right? So I was like, because Fox owns both of those, right? So you can actually do a Predator versus Wolverine movie. Let's do that.
You know, you want some crazy stuff like that? Yeah, Wolverine versus Predator. Yeah, why not?
I mean, I'm just saying, why not? They did it in the comic books. They have Batman versus Predator in the comic books. Why not? Why can't we do something like that? They can, because you can have the X-Files and X-Men, because
Disney, oh yeah,
both of those. So
With this
I'm a big nerd, by the way.
That's no problem. I love it. That's no problem. So with this kind of big boom that we've seen of a lot of different stuff, of, you know, all these comic properties, movies, shows, everything like that, why don't you think that's translated into actual comic book sales and then people actually going to pick up comic books and reading more and everything like that, you think?
That is a difficult question, right? So I think there's a lot of different factors, right? So one of the things is there's a lot more competition. So when comics were like, there was one particular point in American history when comics were selling in the millions, like everybody read comics, just like how it is in Japan and like France, right? Because, you know, are you familiar with like the French market of comics? It's
oh, no, I'm not too much.
It's envious. I'm envious of it. You know, it's you walk into like a French comic book store, it's like walking into a Barnes & Noble. It's massive, and everybody reads comics, and it's an art form, you know, because it's treated like it's actually respectable, you know. Several things that happened to our form is like, you know, in the 1950s, of course, with, you know, the Senate subcommittee hearings where they forced comics to self-censor because they said that they were making kids into juvenile delinquents, right? So basically they created the Comics Code Authority to self-censor comics. So they took all of the piss and vinegar out of comics, you know. All the creativity and everything went to the superhero. So now people conflate a genre with a medium, right? So you say comics, people are like, oh, superheroes, funny animals, you know?
Yeah.
That's one of the things, right? So they don't look at it as a legitimate medium. Like people are like, they still make comic books? And that's because what happens also is that in the late 1970s, comic books stopped being sold on the newsstands and everywhere. Like, remember, like, you could actually, I mean, back in the day, I used to go get my comic books from a Stop and Go. I used to go to a gas station, get comics, you know? But when the direct market happens, a lot of people of color, I didn't have a comic book store in my small hometown in Mississippi, right? I got my comics from a newsstand, right? Mm-hmm. So what happens in the 1970s is you move them into these, like, specialty shops, a lot of them in the suburbs, actually. A lot of kids of color did not have access to them, you know, until much later. I wasn't able to get a comic book until I went to like graduate school, which is like many years later, right? I didn't even think they still made them because they like disappeared, you know? So you have that too, where it's like access. The other thing is like people are really interested in manga for whatever reason. So I'm not a big manga fan, but manga is like has taken over like that particular aspect of like young readers' sensibilities, actually, because it's coming from this other space. It's a lot more of it, and it's a lot more diverse, right? So the mainstream comics industry still suffers from the mislabeling of it being like a juvenile medium that only deals with like muscle-bound people in tights beating up on each other. You know, that's very limited, you know? Yeah. Whereas like the medium of comics is huge, right? The medium of comics is massive, you know? I mean, you can do a comic book about anything, but what's happened though is like, people have really short-sighted ideas about what comics can do and what kind of stories they can tell, you know? And that's part of it as well. So I think those different factors, like having so much competition, it's very difficult to like build that audience, right? Because it's a stigma that has stuck with comics since the 1950s about it being a juvenile medium and then access and all these different, these other things, you know? But and then people have they think of illustrated fiction and comics as being like for the unintelligent. You know what I'm saying? They don't think about it as being a different type of medium, you know, a different type of storytelling. You know, like for instance, you look at our setup right now, right? We're in a comic book right now. You have two panels, like me and you are panels. Mm-hmm. We have these tags under us. We have this stuff at the top here. We got this information at the bottom. We're actually like processing different types of information simultaneously, right?
Okay.
It's what they call multimodal literacy, which is what we had to develop when we're living in a hypersensitive, like hyper speed, like, you know, world that we're living in right now. Comics can help you get that particular type of literacy very quickly, because sometimes the words are doing different things than the images, right? Or sometimes they're read together. So you're reading the page, you're actually reading these different things happening at the same time. It's a very, very smart way to tell a story. But, you know, for a lot of people, it's just, oh, Superman. Oh, Mickey Mouse. So those are the issues.
Yeah.
They make me upset.
So. I want to talk to you further about just about the medium of comic books. But before I get to that point, I just want to address another point that you said in your talk in there about, because you mentioned manga, how that's doing really well. And then before that, you also mentioned original characters. Nobody wants original characters. But I was going to say, like with manga, you do see a lot of original stuff there and a lot of people picking that up with. And then you see a lot of these manga characters now becoming now almost internationally recognized figures, and manga and anime and manga is way more popular than it was. It has a huge boom too. So what do you think that is? Because like you have characters, I know you say you don't read manga, but you do have people like Goku and Luffy from One Piece and things.
Yeah,
like
I've heard of those. I've heard of those characters. You know, okay. It's funny because I was at a, at New York Comic Con, and that was this massive image, this statue of One Piece. I didn't know who it was. I just took a picture because I thought it was cool. And then when I posted it on Instagram, I got all these hits: One Piece, One Piece, One Piece. I'm like, what? Who is this character? That's hilarious. And I guess there's a Netflix show now, right?
Yes, they made it into live action. Yeah.
So yeah, live action Netflix thing. So I don't know. This thing about manga is really interesting to me. Like the Japanese won the culture war. Well, I guess we both did because all the kids are spinning on their heads and doing hip hop, and we're into manga, right? And anime. And don't get me wrong, I do love some of the anime films from back in the day. Like I'm a big fan of like stuff like Akira and like Paprika and Perfect Blue. You know, these really beautiful, Miyazaki's work is gorgeous. And also too, I'm a big Junji Ito fan. So, I do read some, But I think that there's something that the ubiquitous nature of it, like, back in the day when there was borders and stuff, people would actually literally go to borders and just read the manga section all the time. They wouldn't buy them.
Right.
They'll just go and read. It'd be like they treat it like a library. The other thing too is that there's a lot of access to manga online for free as well, which I think also has perpetuated that thing too. I think one thing I would have to say about people that publish manga is they take better care of their fans as well. So for instance, what's the type of mangaka where the fans can make it to?
They can make it as well.
Yeah. So basically it's like fan fiction that's supported by the publisher where they will actually let you publish. I think they get a percentage of it or something, but they will actually let you make fan fiction.
Okay.
And publish it. So there's stuff like that where they actually take care of the fans a lot better, which I thought was kind of cool. So when I said that nobody wants the new characters, I meant like in the superhero, in the mainstream, the people who are reading superhero comics really just want the same thing over and over. I feel that way. Like they just want to, they don't want anything to change. And if you think about it, like manga is about change, right? It's a bunch of it. It's always shifting. It's the same story, but it's always like, there's a lot of things that are changing. Superheroes are like stuck in amber. Think about it. Peter Parker is how old again? Like how old is Batman? Batman was created in 1939. He's perpetually young, and they always read. So rebooting. In order for them to get new readers, right? Mm-hmm. You have to actually either come up with a younger version of them, like Robin or like Nightwing or something like that, and bring them in, Red Hood or whatever, bring new readers in. Or you realize too that, demographically, and I know that people, that are racist people don't like to hear this, but we are browning. I'm sorry, but America is becoming a browner space. I think white people become like a ethnic minority in like the year, 2045 or something like that. I think that's what the projections are.
Possibly. Yeah.
So it's not like no one's trying to replace anybody, but there's a lot of melanin in America. And so that's one of the pushbacks too, where it's like, you're going to take my Captain America and you're going to take my country. I'm like, okay, no, it's not that serious. Actually, we're just living, right? We're Americans as well. So if they want to get like new characters, you have this thing where you have to like maintain the character to a certain degree because you have licenses, but you also have the thing, you want to grow your audience, right? And the old audience for comics is graying and dying, just like the old audiences for old school hip hop are now grandfathers and stuff, right? So you have this progression of people who want things to stay the same, and you have the things that you where you're trying to like create a new audience. So what do you do? You have to create these spinoffs. So it's like, okay, we tried to create new characters, nobody wanted them, right? So we need to create we need to build off this brand and create like Kid Flash, and now Aqualad is black and queer, right? So, and you have a Mexican Blue Beetle that's actually pretty popular, or, a lesbian Latina version of this Question, right? The Montoya version of the Question. So you, you're trying to speak to these different characters and different demographics, but also still keep the brand of the, it's a very like difficult thing to do. Manga is doing it automatically because it's already kind of like exoticized anyway, because it's cool. It comes from another country and you read it backwards and it's so much of it. And it's like, it's really like, so you can have all kinds of different types of manga. Like you could have like adult manga. You have a manga for kids. You got manga for housewives. You have mangas for cooks. You
know, romance,
exactly. Yeah. Romance used to be a big aspect of comics in our, you know, in our country. You know, men used to read romance comics. Men created romance comics. You know, that was a big thing back in the day. So you know, we killed comics because, you know, we felt that they were messing up our kids, because America's like always been super conservative in a certain way, and was like, no, these comics are going to change everything. Oh my God. Batman and Robin are gay. It's going to make everybody gay. I'm like, what? No, that's not what's happening. But no, but seriously though, I think the manga gives people a broader spectrum of the new, you know, and it's always new to somebody. I always say like somebody right now is listening to Prince for the first time ever. Right. For the first time, somebody in the world right now has never heard Prince before. It's put on Purple Rain and their mind is being blown right now, you know? Yeah. So that's what
because to that point, before I go into my next question for you, because I think it was Lil Yachty, I think it was, who's a rapper, by the way.
Mm-hmm. I know who Lil Yachty is.
hey, that's Emo. And then he was talking, I think he said that he heard Pink Floyd for the first time, and he was like, that really kind of changed his mind, blew his mind there. And I think that it's good for, and I'm just talking about from Black people here for a second, just Black people, to span, to go around, look at all these different influences, not just stay in a bubble there. And I think, you know, that's kind of the worst thing. And, you know, maybe even a misconception that Black people do this and certain groups of people do this and other groups of people don't do these other things. And I think that's damaging there. So,
yeah,
it's always good to kind of branch out there and do different things. And my other point there that I was going to bring up another question. So, like, yeah, you see this kind of influence there with manga, especially with younger kids, and then the anime, and then you know you get hooked there, that translation, and there's so many different forms of manga that you can read there. So do you think that the main thing with comics is that it's just the older people kind of complaining more, that you're not, like, they're not doing a good job of connecting to the younger kids and getting them hooked on the stuff? Because when I was growing up, you know, the way I got into comic books was through the animated stuff, Static Shock, Justice League the animated series, Batman the animated series.
Most people still do.
Batman Beyond, that type of stuff, and that kind of, and then I know a lot of people, you know, when you speak about the Green Lantern movie, you talk about your mom saying, like, you know, you want to go see that. When that happened, they were like, wait, he's white? Like, a lot of people didn't know that, you know, there was a different version of Green Lantern.
Right.
So do you think it just struggles with a lot of comic books, the two big companies especially, struggle with hooking the younger kids? Because that's really what you got to go with, because that's your future audience.
I go back and forth about it. I think what's happened is, because of the success of the video games and the cartoons and the films, you do have a massive like following of young folk. Like my little cousin, she is, let's see, she's out of school now. She's gotta be like 18. She one of the biggest Marvel heads. She don't read the comics though, you know. She's a big Marvel fan though. You know, she loves those movies. So, and she loves the video games. And I think what happens, I said, well, you need to read the graphic novels then. She didn't really know about that. And so she started reading Spider-Man and stuff like that now. So what it is that, like I said, the direct market is dwindling. Like, you know, we have like closures, like, you know, comic book stores are closing. Diamond, because of COVID, had to do some different things with how they do distributing stuff, and like Marvel is like now being distributed by Penguin Random House. DC has its own distribution company, so you know you've seen like a massive shift, like a tectonic shift in what's happening in mainstream comics, and it's really kind of a wild west right now. People are trying to figure out things, and Kickstarter is a big game changer as well. I would say that the most interesting things in comics for like adults are happening in the trade presses. Like, we're making some great books. Megascope is making great books. You know, we just put out an Afrofuturist Count of Monte Cristo book, you know, and it's really good, right? We're getting ready to drop an Anansi the Spider horror story, right? For adults. It's not for kids, right? So, we work on an Emmett Till graphic novel right now, you know, stuff like that. So, you know, we are trying to shake up the market, but you also have stuff like Kickstarter with like, you let the audience vote, you know, but then you also have like successful endeavors, like with Kickstarter, with like Ripperverse. I mean, brothers made a lot of money, you know, have to say. And but you also have like really successful folk like Richard Kirkman with The Walking Dead, where it's like he has a contract where he owns The Walking Dead. Image is putting out the comics, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's a very different landscape right now, you know. And I think honestly, like Marvel and DC don't necessarily have to make better comics actually, or do the things that people want them to do, because you know, that's not where their main money comes from. They got theme parks. My kid has like, you know, Incredible Hulk pull-ups right now. You know what I'm saying? So they're selling those characters. You know, they're selling those characters, but not necessarily in the main in the direct market. So, and those that's a danger. That's a space right now where there's just enough for you to actually to make a little bit of money, but you know, it's a system that actually has a lot of issues, and you know, for good or ill, you know, things are going to have to shift to kind of make up for that. You know, it's difficult to make money in comics too. So,
go back with something you said about comic books as a medium.
Yes,
and you see that. So, I feel like you know, it's the way you kind of talk about it. I saw another interview when you spoke about this as well. And do you think that's just primarily kind of a Western type of thing? Because we also have that kind of outlook on animation. Like animation is just for kids. You know, it's not just a medium to tell a story. But then over in Japan, to bring up Japan again, you see something like Hayao Miyazaki with The Boy and the Heron or his other various works.
I hear that Blue Eye Samurai is like a masterpiece, right? I'm like, I haven't seen it yet, but I want to see it. Like my dude David Walker was telling me, like, yo, this is amazing. You need to see it immediately. So, you know, I respect his opinion, so I'm gonna check it out. So yes, that's what it is. Our society has been known to be very short-sighted because you think about it. I mean, we were started by these really conservative, like religious folk, the Pilgrims. Right? You know, like really, really conservative, you know? So, you know, we're not teaching critical thinking properly in schools, you know what I'm saying? We're teaching indoctrination and stuff like that. We're scared of things that are different, that are quote unquote different from us. So that's ingrained in the culture. You know, it's like we're supposed to be a free thinking society, but you know, we should have free education. We should have free healthcare. You know, this kind of stuff. Like we're like behind the times, but we're acting like we're not. You know, and that's what the thing is too. And so I think sometimes because the superhero represents like a particular type of like nostalgia for the good old days, you know, that people are hanging on to that idea. But I'm like, we need to grow past that, man. I mean, you're missing so many things. Like I'm trying to make comics that are like groundbreaking and stuff, right? That actually like change how we look at the medium. You know, it's a medium. It's not a genre, and people like don't understand that. So if I give them, say, like, you know, our book Queenie that we put out is up for an NAACP Image Award this year, you know, it's our second nomination. It's the story of Stephanie St. Clair, you know, and she was a gangster in Harlem, right, back in the 1920s. So that's not for kids, but it's a really, really beautifully told story. So there you have it. But anyway. I could talk about that all night. So,
I mean, what do you think needs to be done to kind of change that? Because you do have a lot of comic books there that are, you know, not just like superheroes that do get popular. You do have stuff like Saga that got very popular. You did have ones that have been turned into movies that not many people would think of when they first hear comic book movies.
Like, yeah, like Road to Perdition.
Road to Perdition, A History of Violence, Ghost yeah. World, yeah. You know, stuff like that. So what do you think kind of needs to be done to kind of change?
Oh man, that's a tough question too, because again, people are so distracted, you know, by so many different things, you know. There's so much prejudice against the medium, I think, in our country, that we need to work through that. We need to it's about educating, you know, and a lot of it's in schools too. I think what's happened now is a lot of people like myself who grew up reading comics are now implementing, like my students read some of the first graphic novels that they ever read in my classes, right? Because I teach courses on comics, you know, so some of the first comics that they've ever opened are in college, right? That's crazy to me. So I think what needs to happen is we need to think more broadly about how we're educating people about what good art is, you know? But that happens on like the educational level, you know? And education, you talk about a system that is broken intentionally, that the education system is beautifully broken. It's broken to function the way it was designed, you know? so it's like, you know, it's a tough road. And the thing is too, is like getting people's eyes and ears out, you know? Everybody's not going to comic book conventions. Everybody's not going to American Library Association. We have to go where the people are, you know? And really say, I just did a talk at, I do talks at libraries because that's where people gather to kind of learn information sometimes. So, you know, I just did a talk 2 weeks ago about Afrofuturism and comics, you know? So we have to be, you know, evangelists of comics as a medium and get the good word out, you know? But it's gonna be a lot of work because people are so set in their ways. People don't like to change. You know, change is difficult, you know? People won't change unless they're forced to, seriously. That's what it is. And so until something really, really big happens and stuff, we're gonna be having to fight this battle. Cause I've been fighting this battle since the 90s in particular about comics and education. Like people are like, wait, people still make comics? Wait, that's a comic book? I used to read comic book. It was read Casper the Ghost. I said, I used to read that too, along with everything else, you know? But it's a difficult conversation because people still don't think of it as something that someone who's smart would read. You know, when you give them Mouse or you give them like Stuck Rubber Baby or The Sandman and they're like, whoa, what am I reading? You know, that kind of thing. So, yeah.
Especially something more modern instead of.
Oh, yeah.
Something more way better. Like, I guess Watchmen, I guess, considered that's more older classic stuff like that.
Yeah, know? Yeah, yeah.
Like that there. Yeah, I don't want to keep you for too long there. I know we said we only do 30, but I know we went past that.
Yeah, I knew when you said 30 minutes, we were going to go past. That's not really real talk 30 minutes.
Everything like that. But one more time, where can people kind of find you if you want to? What you got coming up next? All your projects, everything like that?
Whew. Okay. Let's see. Well, you can find me online pretty much everywhere. I'm at John Jennings Art on Instagram. I'm at johnjenningsstudio.com. You can email me there. I work for the public, so you can actually, you can find my email through University of California, Riverside pretty easily, you know, so you can find me, you know. Yeah, that's my Insta right there. Far as like projects, the main project I'm working on right now is adapting Parable of Talents with Dr. Damian Duffy and David Brain right now. We're working very hard to get that done. That's the follow-up to Parable of the Sower. Which you like to say this one is the Hugo Award for best graphic novel. Me and Angelique are in the throes of like working with a new editor on getting My Superheroes Black out as well. And also I'm writing some other stuff. I'm working on a new like horror miniseries with Vault right now. And we'll talk about that a little bit more but I'm writing that. And those are some of the bigger things. I'm always making art. I got a lot of plans to make my own stuff. And you can pick up stuff like Civil Surfer Ghostlight right now. And also I'm, curating work for Megascope right now too. So our next big release is this book called Devour, written by Jasmine Joyner and illustrated by Anthony Pugh. So that drops in May. And I'm helping to put together the Schaumburg Black Comic Book Festival right now, too. So that happens in April, like late April, 26th and 27th. So, yep.
Yeah, very good. Hopefully, much success to you. You see a lot of kind of Black creators out there doing a lot of great things, kind of coming up more and more. I hope to see that not only just in the medium of comic books, but in film and television. Yep. And I know a lot of people kind of talk about that of like, I saw this really head-ass kind of tweet of like, white people have shows like Succession and The Bear and like, what's our kind of equivalent to that? And then and movies and, especially like you have things like American Fiction, which, I don't know how many people have seen American Fiction.
It's really good.
It's great.
It's so good. I was like, wow, I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
Yeah. So great things. Thank you again for your time there, Mr. Jennings. Take care and have a great one.
You too, Josh. Thank you so much for having me.